This is Larissa Macklem, and you are listening to Frequencies, a podcast from the library at UBC Okanagan. Today I will be talking with Miles Thorogood from UBC Okanagan's Faculty of Creative and Critical Studies.
My name is Miles Thorogood. I'm an instructor here at UBC.
We are here today as part of our Science Literacy Week podcasts. Thank you so much for coming in. Perhaps to start, you could tell us a little bit about your background.
So I'm a product of the research agenda of the new media art of the 1990s, where a number of institutions around the world and creative practitioners were asking the question about what happens if we start to intersect the arts and the sciences, specifically computer science, but then also mixing other branches of science into that as well, with the idea of having some artistic or creative endeavor that's attached to that. And so you have, artists such as, Stellark, who was working with engineers and roboticists and his body in creating these, quite wild performance pieces. Mm-hmm. And to elevate myself into that kind of field of working in the arts and sciences, I would be taking courses in interactive multimedia, which included computer science as well as formal music training, and then other kinds of artistic practice and scientific courses as well.
Quite the blend. And is that a trajectory that you had anticipated for yourself as a younger person, seeing a not strictly arts or strictly kind of science path? Is that something that you always knew that you wanted, was kind of an interwoven perspective?
It's just something that made sense for me going forward. Mm-hmm. One of the difficulties with taking this kind of blended form of learning of arts and sciences was that, talking with colleagues or fellow students that were in the scientific discipline, they'd be like, well, we don't really understand exactly what you're trying to do because it's, not completely science what you're doing from our understanding of what science is. And then talking with traditional artistic practitioners, they're like, well, you're creating stuff, that's kind of cool, but I'm not too sure I understand why you might be working with technology because that's not what I do. So there's a point where it's an identity crisis almost of which camp do I belong into as far as my academic and practice goes. And so, just threw the idea of that worrying me out the door and just kept on doing it. The things that made sense to me, putting together this kind of learning trajectory.
So could you tell us a little bit about your current projects or areas of research?
So current project is called Audio Metaphor. Audio Metaphor is a system that turns text into sound designs. So a user will type in a sentence into the computer, such as, I'm on the beach in Mexico, the sun is shining and the gulls are making noise in the background. And the program will then do a text analysis by finding semantic identifiers in the text, as well as taking out some sentiment attributes as well, things such as mood. So we could expect a sunny day to be, positively balanced or have a pleasurable sort of sound to it. The system will then be able to go through a series of information retrieval steps of searching large databases of audio files to find parts of those audio files which match the search criteria that has been extracted from the sentence. Then use a number of artificial intelligence algorithms, including machine learning, to be able to select parts of those sounds and to combine them together to create the final sound design, which is a representation of the text input.
Hmm, that sounds very interesting. Do you have a favorite output of the Audio Metaphor so far?
At the moment, I'm liking outputs which tend to be positively valenced but have a low amount of arousal to them. Mm-hmm. So things such as quietly walking in the forest. So I enjoy that kind of motif.
Right.
Well, let's take a listen to a sample soundscape. Here's a clip of A Sunny Day by the Seaside.
Furthering kind of the questions around science literacy specifically. So what courses are you teaching this upcoming term? And how do you hope to blend in opportunities for your perspective on science literacy into those courses?
Mm-hmm. So the courses that I'm going to be teaching this coming term are Computer Science 150, that is Physical Computing, and also Media Theory. I'm teaching a visual arts course also, which is sound art. And in these courses, I take a design thinking perspective to the way that students are able to formulate problems, to come up with alternative solutions, and to carry out unfolding of one of those solutions and then evaluate that. So the physical computing course, I'm getting them to make Internet of Things devices, as well as design systems where that can be meaningful as well. So taking a human-centered approach to the design of Internet of Things-enabled devices and objects. The sound art course I'm going to be teaching, which is a second-year visa course, will include a performance aspect to it, an instrument building, as well as a data sonification project too. And so in undertaking those projects, students will be doing not only the design, but also the development of the systems that are required to be able to create sound with a computer and maybe marry that with acoustic instruments also, and then also be able to make sense of data using sound.
So the scientific principles, like just the trial and error kind of experimental design, those are kind of the key practices that you essentially are drawing from the realm of science at a very basic level.
Mm-hmm. Cognitive science also plays a big part, especially within the sound art field, of looking at how human creative processes can be represented by a computer in the machine. Then perceptual psychology will also play a big part in that. So we'll be having a look at some of the research of early acoustic researchers like Claude Risset, Max Matthews, at some of the psychoacoustic kinds of effects that we can then synthesize using the computer.
Hmm. Are there any areas that you have found yourself needing to do some research in that you hadn't anticipated?
In regards to the classes that I'm going to be teaching?
Or in your own research itself?
Well, it's often the case that you start researching something and then you realize that it fits into a research field of its own. So for example, when I was doing some research regarding the soundscape and the sound design composition, I was having a look at it from a human-centered perspective of how people perceive sound. I was doing it initially from sound design practice and design field. After exploring that somewhat, it was came across that really what we're doing was looking at the field of affective computing, and some early research in that domain by Rosalind Picard, and then also UBC researcher. We're looking at how we can represent mood within a particular Cartesian space. And so by mapping sounds out into this sort of affective perceptual space, we then use that as our model for being able to have a computer make human-like decisions based on mood attributes of sound in the sound design process.
You've also had, I think, in your career, a number of public installations of pieces. Is that correct?
Yes. So my moonlighting is as a new media artist. So I work within the domain of interactive artworks and installations. And these have been displayed at Vancouver Olympics, as well as various galleries and public spaces in Canada, Australia, and elsewhere.
And any time that you're putting out an installation, do you have a best case, like desired outcome for the impact of that installation?
So always public engagement is central. So typically, we'll have a design brief about what it is that we're wanting to create. So it might be there's going to be some narrative or story that underlies the purpose of the installation, always. But then it's like, well, do people just understand what it is that you're trying to relate to them as far as the narrative goes, or do they get engaged, at a deeper level? And so what we have a look at doing is going through the design process of thinking about who the user is or who the viewer is in this case. So that goes to the idea of different kinds of viewer types that you might experience, in a museum, for example, where you will have school children coming through, you'll have adults coming through, of a weekend, maybe taking their grandparents out, and they will all want different things, get different things from what it is that they're going to be interacting with. So for example, you'll have some users or viewers which are just interested in taking a very surface level reading of the installation. Other ones which want to be able to explore it more deeply, and other ones which are interested in showing other people what it is that they've learned from it as well. So taking these visitor types into consideration is important.
And how do you go about getting the feedback on who is using and how they are using the installation? Do you sit there as a bystander and just observe people, or how do you go about getting that information?
Yeah, so evaluation of public art is a tricky thing and an open problem. So typically when we go to evaluate systems that we're designing in our research, what I'll have a look at is saying listen to this soundscape that my system has developed or generated, and then listen to something that a human has generated and tell me which one you prefer. And if the the statistics come up and show that there's no significant difference between how people rate soundscapes or sound designs which are generated from my system compared to ones that humans have generated, I can say that it produces human-like sound designs. But within the public art context, what you can look for is you sit and have the look and take an observation about how people are playing and interacting with the system. So maybe they're taking more time than you would expect for somebody that would not be interested in it. So let's say that somebody who's not interested or doesn't get involved in the interactive artwork might spend 30 seconds because they're walking past it, maybe walking slowly, but they're not really involved in it. Whereas somebody who is getting involved in it and they've designed the unfolding of the experience to take like 10 minutes, maybe they're spending 7 minutes there. So you could say it's more or less effective because they're spending 7 minutes in front of it instead of 30 seconds. Now, 7 minutes is still probably a long time for people in public art context to be engaged with something. But the longer you can get somebody to be involved with your story and your message, you can consider that to be more of a success. Now, the way that we can take those metrics is by sitting down and observing, but that can obviously take a lot of time because, well, these installations, they don't really turn off while the venue is open. Now, because we're dealing with computational technologies, what we can also do is to observe the metadata of the user's behavior and glean some information from that and be able to evaluate the exhibition based on those.
In general, do you think the typical public is very computer science literate?
It's going to be changing more and more. We're finding that children which are working their way through the K-12 program becoming, they call them digital natives, or various other kind of nomenclature which is associated with people that have been using technology since infancy almost now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between using technology and being able to create something with technology.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more we're seeing technology pervasive in our culture. But at the same time, we're seeing it become more and more user-friendly. So a lot of the time, people aren't actually creating or understanding what is happening in the technology that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, programming computers, creating things with digital technology is becoming more and more necessary for students to make it through the K-12 program. In Canada here,
mm-hmm.
We have more science, computer science literacy coming into the foreground of those programs. So when I see people that are working with the installations that I create, often it comes down to button mashing. They'll come and just see how much it works, and if it doesn't seem to work for them, they'll just sort of pass it by because it isn't as user-friendly as something that they might find that's given to them otherwise. So there is this bit of a play between creating something that is user-friendly and then something that requires work to be able to uncover what is inside of it.
Mm.
And being able to create an experience that works for both of those types of viewers, that's where some of the strengths are. So for example, creating something that is immediately accessible, has some moving graphics on it. It has a button that you can push to make the moving graphics move more.
Hmm.
So in the example that I was giving about the simulation of birds, you press a button and it scares the birds and they flutter away or they fly around a little more quickly. But maybe there's a sort of a deeper interaction there as well,
hmm.
where if you just take time and stay still instead of mashing the button and just going for that instantaneous reward of some effect. But if you just take time and spend it there with the system, maybe it starts to evolve further. The birds come closer to you in the screen, and you start to get more of the story. Perhaps they even start speaking pieces of poetry in between each other that you get to hear that you might not otherwise hear if you didn't take that time.
I can see how that would foster some scientific depth of thinking about an installation like that, where, like you said, it's not just going for instant gratification, which is very prevalent in a lot of our interactions with technology these days, but encouraging that waiting attitude and the problem solving of, well, what happens if I wait? What happens if I don't push the button? So that seems a really engaging approach for encouraging that in a really non-stressful, not stressful, but in a way that doesn't make people necessarily think that they're learning about scientific principles in a sense. So I just find that a really interesting approach.
Mm-hmm. Or if they start pushing the button in different ways, what if you stroke the button?
Right, yeah. All kinds of things
that. Strokeable buttons.
Yes.
There we go.
Along the lines of general public and scientific and computer science specific literacy, do you have any suggestions that you would make to people listening of things that they could do to improve their own computer science literacy at kind of a deeper level? Because I think a lot of people have a very surface level interaction ability to use and new products and devices, but not necessarily to think deeper about what's going on behind the scenes.
The first step is always start to speak the language of computers.
Mm.
And the language of computers is code. And so looking at creating a simple program, even a web page from scratch, is an empowering vehicle for being able to start to work within the domain of computer science.
Mm.
So we find that to create a web page right now, it doesn't take much. You just go to some template in some content management system,
mm-hmm.
And say here, give me a web page. Here's my name, here's my content, and it basically develops that for you. But cutting your teeth on the tools of web design using HTML5 will give somebody more depth of knowledge than just doing something from a template.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the nice things about computer science and computer literacy is that all the good stuff is free. It's based on open standards. So if we're talking about web design, then it's based on HTML5, which is open web standards. There is a plethora of good resources out there online that someone can start to look into for creating their own web space. The Mozilla Developer Network is one such vehicle, and that's the work from the Mozilla Foundation,
mm-hmm.
which looks very much at computer literacy and extending the knowledge of being able to work in computers to a wider audience in an open and free way.
Hmm.
Similarly, moving on from there, if you were to develop apps for phones or other kinds of software, then again there is many free tools and free programming languages,
mm-hmm.
That people can start to tackle.
Hmm.
So it's always what is interesting for somebody, and once they can articulate what the thing that they are interested in is, there is a solution out there within the domain of free open source software that they can start to play around. One such tool that can also extend beyond building web pages is processing.org, and this is an implementation of a Java-like language that allows you to create dynamic and interactive graphics very easily, and so that's one of the tools that we would teach students that are taking a design and computer literacy course.
Hmm. That's a great bunch of resources that you've mentioned. Thank you.
When you are communicating your research out, do you find that you communicate it differently to different audiences?
That's something I certainly try to do. For example, speaking with colleagues in the field of computer science, talk about the algorithms that we develop and that we implement into our research in a way that we expect they will they'll have knowledge of that set of algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas speaking with somebody who is within a different field, let's say the artistic community, I'll speak much more about the higher level sorts of design decisions and processes that we're looking at modeling, not necessarily the implementation of the modeling itself. Being able to communicate to different audiences is certainly something that is very important, because science touches us all, and we all have different ways of accessing it.
That seems like a perfect wrap-up statement. So I'd just like to thank you, Miles, for coming in and talking with us today. It's been a really engaging conversation, and I hope our audience gets as much enjoyment out of it as we've had today. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
The soundscapes you heard as part of today's podcast were created with the website audiometaphor.ca, a tool created by Miles Thorogood. You have been listening to Frequencies, a podcast from the library at UBC Okanagan. I was your host today, Larissa Macklem. Editing by Karen Hoag, Larissa Macklem, Anna Marie Cron, and Matthew Viz Dunbar. Music by Trevor Neal. Artwork by Allison Ward. Additional support provided by Michelle Tinling, Sajni Lacey, and Ariel Lomnes. Thank you for listening.